AI in its generative form is already taking over epistemic tasks, things like writing a letter, or if you're religious, writing a sermon, or, you know, demonstrating a particular useful application of AI that will take over a task previously done by a human being. So we're already seeing that kind of level of replacement and automation in our systems that could lead to people losing income.
In robotics and in AI, deep learning gives you the ability to instruct the AI to reprogram itself if it would help it better meet its objectives. Now, there are some guardrails and parameters around that, I'm sure, but again, given how hard we're trying to catch up with exactly how do you give precise instructions that are the ones you really mean, and given how bad we are as that at humans, it's quite difficult to know whether you've absolutely made that as safe as possible by only giving the right instructions to the AI such that it would be able to make, quotes, the right decision, which is this thing about alignment and control.
Hello and welcome to Unbelievable, the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking. Before we begin today's show, a reminder that we always want to hear what you think of our discussions. So please let us know your thoughts by emailing unbelievable@premier.org.uk or leaving messages on our Premier Unbelievable Facebook page or on Twitter at UnbelievableFE. Also, you could win our monthly prize book giveaway simply by signing up to our newsletter through registering on our website, which is premierunbelievable.com. So don't miss out for your chance to win. And now for today's discussion.
Hello and welcome to Unbelievable, the show that tries to get Christians and non-Christians alike thinking about the topics that matter to all of us. I'm Roger Bolton, and this week we're going to talk about AI, artificial intelligence, is well and truly with us, designing more effective drugs, reading scans better than any human. ChatGPT, Midjourney are just two of the things that have burst into our consciousness. Some experts would now like to try and pause the development of AI. Is it possible? Should we do so? Or should we embrace it and make it more like us? Does it threaten our unique place in God's creation? Those are some of the questions we're going to discuss this week. And looking with me round the corner to see where AI is going and what we should do about it are two experts. Eve Poole, OBE, is a British writer, theologian, and has served as the Third Church Estates Commissioner. She's one of our most senior lay people in the Church of England. She was the first female chairman of the, well, I suppose not a chairman, first female chair of the Board of Governors at Gordonston School in Scotland, and her books include Capitalism's Toxic Assumptions and Leadersmithing. And she's been writing about consumerism and God, but her latest book is Robot Souls, Programming in Humanity. Just before we go on, Eva, can you tell me, what is Leadersmithing? Is it the equivalent of a blacksmith?
It is a bit, or a silversmith, or a goldsmith. Yeah, it's taking the idea of leadership as being too static a way to explain what the day-to-day craft of leading is, and borrowing from the world of craft to articulate better the messiness and the journey towards mastery that's required to get that right.
So it's a guidebook for potential leaders, but is it for more? Is it for all of us?
Handbook.
I mean, is it for all of us, or just specifically focused on people who want to be leaders, investors?
It's for all of us. It's a sort of DIY manual, which is if anyone's following you, you're leading, so you might as well figure out what the craft skills are and figure out how you deploy them well. Because individually, those individual things like listening or asking difficult questions or coaching, all those things aren't necessarily difficult. But sometimes it's difficult to coordinate them well, do them under pressure, scale them. Particularly when you're having an off day. So it's a book that takes seriously the neuroscience of learning and muscle memory for leadership, and helps you figure out how you might tool yourself up to be able to do that in all kinds of different environments.
You know, I should have read that book before, Tooling Up and so on, before I did this discussion, but never mind. Also with us is Beth Singler. She's assistant professor in digital religion at the University of Zurich. And prior to that, she was the junior research fellow in artificial intelligence at Homerton College, University of Cambridge, after being the postdoctoral research associate on the Human Identity in an Age of Nearly Human Machines project at the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion. Beth explores the social, ethical, philosophical, and religious implications of advances in artificial intelligence and robotics. And can I ask you, Beth, how did you get into this? I mean, when did you have a moment where you thought, right, I have to devote myself to this subject, or was it a gradual awareness?
Well, for me, it really starts with being a huge geek and a big science fiction fan from quite a young age and being fascinated by the stories we tell ourselves about the possibilities of artificial life forms. But then from a career perspective, it was really that postdoc position at the Faraday Institute that brought me more from looking at digital religious movements online, new spiritualities, new religious movements, into more consideration directly of artificial intelligence and religion.
And you're certainly obviously a scientist. Are you also a religious person yourself, or someone who is simply fascinated by religion?
I tend as an anthropologist to describe myself as agnostic. I think that's a good approach to have as a digital ethnographer, as a cultural anthropologist. So I don't tend to ascribe to one specific religious tradition, but I'm interested in many different interpretations of what's happening with artificial intelligence.
And Eve, obviously you're a member of the Church of England, and do you come at this as a scientist and as a Christian?
Yes, I suppose so. I'm technically an Episcopalian in Scotland these days, but when I was third commissioner, I was a communicant member of the Church of England. I suppose I'm a cradle Christian. I have a theology degree, but I also have a business degree and have written about economics as well as looking at AI now. So I wouldn't describe myself as a scientist. I think I'm a business leader with a theological background who's very curious about humanity, particularly given my role teaching at a business school for so many years and trying to figure out how we perfect ourselves as humans, should that be possible, either on our own or with the help of AI.
That seems to me when we come to AI, so the world divides into two. There are those who are just fascinated by its possibilities and dwell on the benefits and whatever. And the rest of us, I suppose, say, we're just played scared. So just before we get into it, are you scared at all, either of you? Really, really scared about what we're facing? How about you, Beth?
So I tend to make a distinction between existential hope and existential fear in people's discussions of AI, and I don't think I fit neatly into either of those. What I do tend to say is that I have concerns about the near-term and current uses of AI, and I'm a little bit more skeptical and agnostic, as I say, about the far future interpretations of AI, which tend towards more sort of exponential, even eschatological beliefs about AI.
And how about you, Eve? Are you more frightened or excited by the possibilities?
I think both. I was taking my little twins to the beach in North Berwick, and they were washing around diggy holes and splashing around in the shallows and building sandcastles. And behind me on Berwick Law, there was an Iron Age fort. And I thought, well, gosh, this is a very timeless picture of children pottering around on beaches, having a childhood. And I suddenly felt a wave of sadness that if this great plan to optimize into AI ever went ahead, there would be no more children on beaches because robots don't have childhoods. And I wanted to understand, is there anything special about us? You know, do we have a right to exist beyond any, you know, future where there is a singularity and AI can take over on most fronts? And so I really wanted to explore that by trying to understand what is special and different about us, if anything, and what should our relationship be with AI?
Well, that's a very profound thought about our uniqueness or temporary uniqueness and et cetera, et cetera. But perhaps we should define terms before we start, because a lot of people wouldn't be quite clear, and that was include me until recently, about what artificial intelligence is and whether actually it is intelligence we're talking about here, or sort of a form of cleverness. So what is AI, Beth, today? What can it do today before we go on to where it's going to lead? What can it do today?
Well, you have to understand at first the origins of the term in the 1950s, when basically a group of 10 men got together, decided to combine several different fields like cybernetics and systems theory to create this thing, this field, this object they were talking about called artificial intelligence. And there's a fantastic quote by someone called Robert Wilinsky, who talks about how in trying to define intelligence, they looked around at who they thought were intelligent people, and they decided that they themselves were intelligent people, and the two things they were particularly good at were solving theorems and playing chess. So their definition of artificial intelligence is very much structured on their own culture of what they thought they were as intelligent beings. Now, when you sort of dial up to today, and that's sort of there still in our, the DNA of our conversations about AI. If it can solve particular problems, we're going to call it intelligent, but it doesn't have any of the embodied intelligence or the general intelligence that humans have. It's very narrow. It's sometimes referred to as narrow artificial intelligence. It can do specific tasks to even a super intelligent level. The way that AlphaGo can play the game of Go is super intelligent because it's played against itself millions of times. And that's simply something humans can't do to improve. It's a completely different attempt at intelligence. But it can't then get up from the table and decide to go make itself a cup of tea. It doesn't have general capabilities. It's very focused on one task.
So yet, we probably should say. And so when people are looking at artificial intelligence now, I think they're beginning to understand the way in which it, we always use the word revolutionize, don't we? But significantly change work and do, Eva, a range of things that that we can't do or can do it better than we can or more quickly than we can and so on. So it's a form of, you know, form of industrial revolution in one way that we're looking at. And a lot of businesses would be focusing in that. And a lot of people would be worried about job losses and so on. And those are real issues. But they don't, it's a long way from that to saying that they are replacing human beings as human beings. What do you think human beings can do now that AI cannot do now?
So my thesis about robot souls is all about junk code, which is my way of describing what I think humans do that AI doesn't currently do. And for the reasons Beth has articulated, there are lots of things we never coded into AI because we thought they were not intelligent and probably devious, or we just found them perplexing and unable to, be turned into zeros and ones. And so there's a whole range of them. There are things like emotions, although we can code some semblance of emotional responsiveness into care bots, for instance. Things like intuition, which is incredibly hard to define or articulate, let alone code into anything. Our ability as humans to be uncertain and to hold several thoughts together at once without resolution. Our ability to make mistakes, not just for kind of mechanical learning, if you like, which is something that AI is absolutely programmed to do, but also for moral improvement and moral learning through the relevance of conscience over time to guide future decisions and to de-risk us, but also our natural propensity to make meaning in everything around us and to tell stories, stories that persist through the generations. So there's a whole range of things that we instinctively do that have been left on the cutting room floor as junk code because they weren't considered intelligent. But they are fundamentally the things that define us as opposed to machines.
But Beth, if is this something which you think is an insuperable problem for AI to look at those things which we perhaps in ourselves most value and look at the way in which we can, as it were, transpose them, if that's the right term? Or do you think we are dealing with two ultimately separate identities here, separate identities, I suppose, humanity, which is a far more complex, and AI, which may be far more intelligent in a narrow sense and more developed, but is on fundamentally a different line?
Well, I think Eve's point is very important, that the simulation of some of these things is very, very simple, very easy. And you don't even actually need to do it to a very sophisticated level before humans jump in with their tendency to anthropomorphize and see the machine as more human-like than it actually is. So asking that question is really difficult to answer because we may just have a simulation of the equivalent of all our messiness that Eve talks about, all that junk code, but not actually the thing itself, but how would we know? So some of the debates about AI is about how we formulate tests to decide whether it's intelligent, whether it has sentience, consciousness, all these large, difficult terms that we use almost interchangeably, but we don't know how to get to that point. So again, I'm going to remain agnostic on the answer to that question because I just don't know if we're ever going to get to purely properly conscious AI. But then, devil's advocate will say, do we always have consciousness in humans as well?
Right, just hold on. My brain is going off in various directions at once. Not good for an older man. Right, but I want to ask you just about the reliability of AI, Beth, here, in the sense that I've assumed that it is better than almost, it's wonderful at taking information that exists, processing it more quickly than we could do and coming up with a certain result, but that it is potentially vulnerable in terms of validating or checking the information that comes in the first place. So at a simple level, if I program in here, give me a picture of a successful, you know, business person, it'll probably give me a 35-year-old white male, because that's the situation at the moment. Now, is that an inherent flaw that can be remedied or not? And it is something that we need to be just aware of when we're dealing with AI today.
It really depends on what form of AI you're talking about. It's such a large umbrella term that at the moment it's taking in a lot of different formats and approaches. We were talking about there with using a prompt to get an AI art example is generative AI. And it's not thinking through the question that you're giving it. It's forming correlations based on probabilities from its data set. So for instance, yes, a lot of our data are human produced content over hundreds, if not thousands of years, tells the machine that yes, if you want a picture of, I can't remember what you said, a smart person?
Yeah, a successful business person.
Our data will tell it that successful business people tend to be white men. That's the existing data. There's the bias is inherent because that's the culture that we have. So yes, the expectation is just, it looks at the probability of what it should produce. It's not making a decision about what it should produce. It's correlating information based on your prompt.
Now, one of the really interesting thing to me about all this debate, and I want to, you know, shortly go on to the worries that we have before we look at other matters, is it's making us, it is, well, is it, Eve, making us think more deeply about what it is to be human? Because now we have to think of how we distinguish ourselves at the moment from AI and what we want, whether we're unique and whether we want things to remain unique. So do you think that's going to be a really interesting debate about what it is to be human?
That's really what I'm hoping to start with this book, because it feels to me that in the short term, we're in danger of having conversations about becoming less human. So in educational policy, it's all about piling in behind the STEM subjects, bleeding out budgets for humanities because they're not seen as useful for jobs to be able to pay off debts, all that kind of stuff. And if you think about many of the STEM subjects, and particularly how they're taught at undergraduate level, they're all exactly the kinds of things that an AI can already do. And of course, there are gender reasons why we want to particularly get women into STEM at the moment, but that's a very short-term thing. So an awful lot of our concern about education at the moment is absolutely going in reverse of all the things I talked about, all the junk code things. So the thing that was making me so worried and cross was that we weren't having a sophisticated enough debate on what really makes us human. We were still trying to compete with what the machines may already be able to do and may be able to do in the future. Because I think there does need to be a season where we think really hard about, are we special and precious? What does make us special and precious? And therefore, how do we reflect that in all of society, not only in education, but in also in, you know, all the investments we make around human flourishing?
And also, I mean, one of the assumptions is that there are answers to everything, or rather there's a specific answers to everything, when our answers often reflect not just our state of knowledge, but our predispositions in a whole range of ways. So that's extraordinarily difficult to factor in, Beth, isn't it? I mean, I remember, I can see when I was taught history at O level, well, you know, here we are, 9 causes of the First World War, bang, 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 bang. Remember, then that's what you have to do to pass the exam. And I can see how you're doing that. But when I look back at what we thought at my youth were the 9, or was thought to be the 9 causes of the First World War, we realized it was rather more complicated than that. And we realized there's a whole raft of things we still don't know, and the motivations of key people and so on. And so do you think there is this danger, just to pick up in a sense what Eve has been saying about not defining, not being aware of the greater complexity, that we think that AI is in specific areas going to give us definitive answers, when even AI will not do that?
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely a very strong narrative, and it comes out of our science fiction to a certain extent, but it's there in popular discourse as well, that AI is somehow going to be superior in its rationality and its neutrality and its objectivity, and therefore it makes a good lens to see the world through. And it was, you know, there's various different projects, Google's doing this, other big companies, to make it more of a user interface for us, that we use these generative forms of AI to search for information, not going to particular websites online through Google or going to a book, if you want to go back further, but just using AI to see the world. Demis Hassabis, the founder of Google DeepMind, has described it in several places as being the ultimate scientific instrument for seeing reality. And all that we're doing is really adding another layer of possible misinformation, disinformation, as I say, with a correlation machine. It's not necessarily giving you the right answer. It's giving you the most likely answer. You can search for information on yourself on ChatGPT, and it will say something that's perfectly reasonable but completely untrue. So the concerns, really interesting, going back to Eve's point about education, the concerns about the use of generative AI like ChatGPT in essay writing really reflects where we've gone to with education, that we want to produce almost sort of binary answers, and AI could give us that, and therefore it's going to disrupt education instead of thinking about how we develop more critical thinking and more kind of those obtuse skills that are really useful.
Is that too pessimistic, in the sense that some people would say, well, actually, no, we'll gradually get to a situation where we'll delegate certain things to AI, but we will then create greater space for ourselves for considering alternatives, the whole range of other things. In other words, we can use our time at university, tutorials, wherever it is, more profitably now, because a lot of the time that was spent on ascertaining certain things, you know, AI will do for us. But you seem to suggest that actually we may not be sufficiently aware of the limitations of AI, and that we may be believing in its potential too much, that actually that's a danger. Over-optimism, in a sense, about its possibilities. Is that it? I want to ask you a moment, Eve, about other dangers, but is that a danger you say is a real one?
Yeah, a lot of my work is looking at the tendency to over-trust and over-believe in the hype of artificial intelligence. Even you mentioned in the introduction the big pause letter where several main figures in technology said, let's hold up a minute, was also a process of encouraging people to see AI as more dangerous than it might be in that more exponential sense. And actually giving those people the chance to sort of capture the regulatory space by saying, we're important, listen to us, we'll define what the problem is, instead of listening to people who are right at the coalface right now with interactions with AI and seeing it take over their jobs. Artists, writers, I have so many friends now who are saying, well, I just didn't get this pitch I made because they decided to use ChatGPT to write it. We're already at a stage where we're seeing societal impacts before we get to this sort of super version of AI that people do really feel that they could trust and almost see as godlike.
Although let's hope it's like a lot of things where, you know, there's the overreaction, then you come back on whatever it is, you know. But can I just before we end this section, Eve, talk to you again, pick up that thought about the industry leaders who said, pause, hey, ho, we're worried where we're going, we need a wider debate. I mean, it sounded to me a bit like, people who were doing... doctors who were getting involved in very complex situations they hadn't anticipated and wanted ethical, moral advice and thinking that they needed a wider debate. Is that, do you think, what industry leaders were about? Or should we be more cynical about that? How seriously should we take that request for a pause coming from parts of the industry itself?
I think it's a difficult question to answer because there's so much cynicism about what game is being played here. But there are certainly a number of experts in AI who feel they've unleashed a monster, and there was kind of no exit strategy. There wasn't really any thought about what this would be and become and where it would go. And there's quite a lot of mutual suspicion because if you think about it, pretty much all AI is in private hands and very little of it is in the public domain. So we don't really know what we're dealing with. They've only released ChatGPT, so we can train it for them. So I think there are a number of organizations are looking over the wall and thinking, well, we've just done something fairly frightening that we're keeping shtum about. I wonder if they've got something even worse. And so I think there's a general panic that maybe this has started to get a bit out of hand, because the second you invent technologies that allow these things to reprogram themselves, you need to know that there would be some way you could control that. Because if you were trying to create something that can think faster than humans, and you allow it to make decisions ahead of humans, and you don't have the right guardrails in place, then of course there's a reason to worry. So I think it is a legitimate worry, and also possibly a realization that we have essentially programmed a master race of psychopaths, because that's what we thought was important. You know, just absolute rationality, being entirely focused on optimizing decisions with, you know, in on your own, really, without much consideration of other people, or particularly not asking for help or talking to others. And so I'm seeing those letters as very much a cry for help, particularly to theologians like me, who've not been in the conversation, to say, well, look, there's a whole realm of other ways of construing human intelligence and what we are, and why we have all these things that you think are junk code, that may be helpful to you in trying to understand how do we make these things safer.
But is it also going to be cynical or worry that somebody will so get such a breakthrough, they will so dominate the market, that other business leaders will find themselves entirely out of business, and therefore you will find one company, if you like, running the AI world? Is that a real, and who knows if another Elon Musk will come along? I mean, is that a real worry, that somebody could achieve such dominance?
Well, we've always had that with any big technology. So I don't think that's a new problem, you know, whether it was the railroads or any other big disruptor that has been invented. There's always a concern about monopoly, which is why there's legislation and a lot of policy thinking about it. Actually, what's more problematic in this environment is that we know from human nature and the whole ecological system that there is strength in diversity, that the reason our species manages to keep going and that the world manages to keep going is that there is so much difference. And the problem about homogenization in AI is you design one AI, one super AI, and we know that in any other environment that would be hugely risky, because you just need one virus to wipe that particular version out. So there is a more catastrophic problem potentially, because if you only have one Uber design to hack, then every single hacker in the world will be pretty motivated to solve that problem once and for all. So there's a really interesting debate, I think, about diversity and how much diversity we're building into our thinking around AI, rather than imagining we will design one superintelligence, which would probably be a disaster.
Well, I'd like to pick that up in our next section, but we're just going to take a bit of a break for the moment. Remember, we'd always love to hear from you, the listeners, but don't forget you can get in touch with us. You can email us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or get in touch via social media at unbelievable, capital F, capital E for Twitter, or facebook.com/premier unbelievable if you want to interact on our Facebook page. Still a massive amount to talk about. You're listening to Premier's Unbelievable with me, Roger Bolton, and my guests today are Beth Singer and Eve Poole. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to part two of this debate about AI, robots, and some might say the future of humanity. Should we be able to try to make robots more like us? What does that mean? What makes us human? With me are Eve Poole, whose new book, Robot Souls, has just come out, and Beth Singler, an anthropologist, and much more, and talking to us from Zurich, where she's an assistant professor. Let's confront some of our worst fears. What are the worst realistic fears about the future development of AI, Beth? The things that don't necessarily happen, but could, if we don't attempt to regulate.
So there's two aspects to that question. There's the actual societal impact, and there's what we can do about it. I'm going to start with the second, because that's a really big debate right now. There are actually options for regulation that are being pushed to one side by various different corporations. Some of the figures behind the pause letter asked for greater regulation, and then organizations and nation states and forms like the EU said, here's some forms of regulation we'd like to bring in. They went, oh, well, we just won't have our product in your areas. So we know there is a difficulty in regulating this space, but there are existing forms of regulation for technology and corporations that could be applied. The first question about what are the immediate harms? Well, we're already seeing them, because AI in its generative form is already taking over epistemic tasks, things like writing a letter, or if you're religious, writing a sermon, or, you know, demonstrating a particular useful application of AI that will take over a task previously done by a human being. So we're already seeing that kind of level of replacement and automation in our systems that could lead to people losing income. And it might not be as simple as, oh, the transition towards the factory structure in earlier centuries meant people were directly made redundant. It might just be people become underemployed, that they find the tasks and the jobs that they were required to do before become smaller and smaller and smaller until they're made redundant. So we have to be very aware of that societal impact on people's day-to-day lives, and also the decisions that are being made by them, made for them by these systems. So for instance, if you apply for a mortgage now, it's quite likely that your existing data set will be scraped over in order to make that decision. If you go into medical treatment, there may be a form of visual recognition being employed on your scans to decide what you have and what your treatment can be. There's decisions being made about what kind of drugs are available. We're implementing all these forms of narrow artificial intelligence already, and they're directly having an impact on people's lives and their livelihoods.
I mean, regulation normally comes about either because ordinary people are just so worried and upset about things, they demand that politicians take action. Or, you know, we hope anyway, far-sighted politicians and others see what's coming, decide there's a need for regulation. Do you think regulation is A, possible, and B, likely, just as it were, to hold us where we are before we go on to the question of where we're going to go?
Well, both, but it's about whether it could be effective. We can certainly bung a load of regulation out there. They will definitely have to do it in order to control, you know, panic globally by having this entirely unregulated as it creeps around, snatching jobs, just to anthropomorphize there. But there is a question of what is law for? You only ever have to have law when normal behavior has broken down, because for some reason people aren't behaving in the way they ought to. So there's a prior question for me, which is, why would you have to regulate AI? And is there something we can learn from this sudden need to have a global panic about regulation that suggests we've got the design wrong? And actually, if we correct the design, we'll need less regulation. And that also reduces risk, because if you're only going to try and control these things through regulation, you're only ever as good as a nation state can be in applying law. And as we can see on even basic things like whether corporations pay their tax, you know, we're quite rubbish at that. So relying on regulation, imagining that might solve problems, is a really sweet idea, but we just know is not true.
Well, the rogue nation theory. I mean, if people of my age brought up, you know, in the post-war, there was this naive assumption that liberal democracy would triumph, et cetera, and that ultimately the nuclear standoff worked because there were rational people on either side. And I don't think we allowed for the gentleman of pleasantly running North Korea. And I'm not sure we ever anticipated that, you know, they'd be fighting in the trenches between, you know, 100 years after the First World War, the trenches will be occupied this time by Russians and Ukrainians and so on. So I think there's been a big, in some ways, for my naive generation, quite a big, you know, warning call. There'll always be, what you're saying essentially, are you, is there always going to be rogue players? And therefore regulation is possible. But we do have regulation which is often relatively successful. Are you saying in this case, Eve, that you either have a regulation in this area that works, you can't have stuff that works relatively?
Well, no, we have to have regulation. I just think that in order for the regulation to be good, you need to know what you're regulating. And because very little of this is in the public domain, there's a danger that the current wave of regulation is addressing problems that are about the AI of 5 or 10 years ago. And by the time those rules have worked their way through various legislatures around the world, AI will have moved on again. So there's that sort of chasing and catching up problem. So of course we need to regulate, but we need to...
Well, sorry, just to interrupt you. Isn't that therefore a case for a pause? You're suggesting that the regulators are so far behind the curve that they need time to catch up. And
yes,
the suggestion,
yes,
some people in this
would
recognise that.
I think sensible for all kinds of reasons. But I think there's also something about transparency. And until we really know what we're dealing with, it's very hard to figure out how you could best regulate. And so I think there is a lot of catching up that needs to be done. But you would have to assume that there was a pause taking place. And I don't think it would be safe to make that assumption.
But are you pessimistic about the possibility of regulation? Will it always be involved in regulating for yesterday?
Yeah, there are a lot of difficulties. I think there's some specific instances where we can see that it might work and specific instances where it just can't work. So for instance, recently a judge ruled that anything created through generative AI, like AI art or text-based material, is not covered by copyright. So that's not top-down regulation, but that's a case-by-case example. But that just means that curtails some of the enthusiasm for generative AI in the creative spaces where people's jobs are going to be replaced. That might slow things down long enough for us to make that decision, do we want to replace our artists and writers? But a second example, recently I saw that a form of generative AI had been used to create a guide to mushrooms. But if you followed this guide to mushrooms, you would die because it was recommending that you eat poisonous mushrooms. Now, you can't regulate against that unless you say you cannot use generative AI to create texts that are then sold online, in which case you have to do away with the entirety of text-based generative AI. You can only go and pursue those particular individuals that have created something harmful. But proving harm and proving responsibility in that regulatory space is very difficult. It's rolling out, as you said, the speed is rolling out much too fast, but the pause really isn't about slowing down for regulation. It's about concern about this more exponential view of AI, that it's going to turn into something that will decide to harm us. And this, as I said, my skepticism about the pause comes because people involved with writing that letter immediately carried on with their projects. Elon Musk was one of the signatories. He immediately has set up his own Twitter/X-based AI unit to scrape all the data that we've been supplying Twitter, now X, for almost decades. So they say one thing, but they do another. So we have to watch what people are actually up to.
Eve, I hope you don't take this wrongly, but you're pretty plugged into the establishment in many ways. Is this a, you know, people are worried about the next election in this country 18 months ago. They're worried about the next election in the United States. But are they worried about anything more than that? When you talk to policymakers at the top, politicians and others, and of course, later on I'll ask you about the consequences of this for churches and for Christianity. Are they seized of this, or do you see it's a very slow waking up going on?
I think it's a very slow waking up. I mean, I'm involved at the moment in the university sector, and you know, in the space of a few short months, we had Oxford, Cambridge, and the Russell Group banning ChatGPT. And then saying, oh, well, maybe we'll let you use it, but you have to declare that you've used it. And now there's another bit of guidance, which is, well, why don't we proactively and positively use it? And here's some guidance. So, there's little excitements. And this is all about plagiarism. And, you know, we had that with Wikipedia, and we solved the previous plagiarism with the web in general with Turnitin. And now we've got to just get better models. But that's entirely missing the point, which is this has the potential to rewrite the way the whole sector operates. It's not just about our kids cheating on their essays. So I think there's quite a lot of fiddling while Rome burns, because it is really difficult to get into this area and it's really difficult to find out about it. There's quite a lot of sort of trespassers beware and leave it to the big guys and all that stuff going on. So it feels impenetrable. It feels terrifying because we will be brought up with sci-fi. So we assume it can only go one way or another. And so I think there is a lot of willful blindness about it. I think there's also a real problem about who is getting involved in this conversation, because it has been left to some very small niche areas in society, and particular personalities and gender, I would say. Beth and I were involved just this last weekend in Greenbelt on a panel, and it was unusual because it was an all-female expert panel on AI. Every single photograph you see in the press, panels on AI, they're all men. So I do think that women need to get more involved, specifically. I think we need to get more involved in understanding the whole realm of different AIs, because as Beth says, there's lots of different things we're talking about here. And I do think the establishment does need to understand this isn't just about a showy showcase, national, international, global summit to show that the UK is taking it seriously and bunging money into the technical aspects. It's about a thoroughgoing policy debate about what we want our relationship with AI to be. I think that's really important.
And yet, you know, you detect usually in this situation two reactions from ordinary people like myself and others. First of all, it's either hopelessness, you know, it's all too complex, just hopelessness. Or in terms of politicians, that's fine, that's very interesting. I want to win my seat in 18 months' time. Okay, I know, for example, take the debate going in London at the moment about extending ULEZ scheme, you know, which was originally brought about the Conservatives. you know, they're confronting the reality of opposition when they have to explain things through. And a lot of your politicians are pulling back, as they often do. So here we'd be asking, it's a very big ask of politicians in many ways, isn't it, here, to say effectively, we are talking about something which is not of immediate impact, but is of such profound, will be of such profound change, we have to address it now. And we haven't even thought of it, and we haven't got policies. I mean, there's such a time lag, it seemed to me, in these things. But maybe inevitably, universities, think tanks, politicians, and then the rest of us get involved. I mean, Beth, have you noticed in the last 2-3 years a real change in the people or the depth of, if you like, how widespread the conversations are starting to be now? Can we be optimistic at least that it's moving out from relatively small areas to a wider range of public debate?
Well, I want to go back a little bit further than 3 years to about, maths in my head is very hard, 7 years ago when I started my postdoc on AI specifically. And very early on, I went to a conference in New York on AI ethics. And on my journey, I took a taxi to the train station to carry on. And my taxi driver, very friendly person, asked me what I do. And to keep it short, I said, oh, I work in AI. And he starts gushing enthusiastically, like, oh, it's amazing what you do. You're really helping the world. It's brilliant what you do. And I'm very surprised. And he says, well, you know, you're helping people have babies. This is fantastic. Because to him, AI is artificial insemination. So this is 7 years ago. I do think the situation has changed now. But for a long time, it was an unknown unknown. This term, I mean, Rumsfeld comes in for a lot of abuse for his unknown unknowns, but it's true. For some people, it's something they don't know about and they don't know what they don't know about it. And increasingly, yes, we've in the last year or so, with the greater accessibility of generative AI like ChatGPT, the fact that OpenAI, I've got some problems with their approach, but they started out with a very closed approach. More recently, they've gone more open to live up to their name and let people use the technology, now been invested into by Microsoft, and it's going to be in all the Microsoft products. Everyone is engaging more and more with artificial intelligent products, and they're being more and more aware that they are. It's still overhyped. Something like 40% of companies pretend they have AI in their product and they don't. So it's very hard to know when you are and you aren't. But I think generally the literacy around AI is increasing. It's still got its unfortunate pockets of over dystopian hype in the press when a very mundane story is illustrated with the Terminator picture. And people then instantly, of course, go to that more like dystopian end of the world scenario. But I think generally, yes, the conversation's growing, and it's particularly growing in the religion and AI space as well. I think that's somewhere I started out back in 2016, and I've seen that exponentially grow.
Well, let's now move from the present to the future, and to Eve, to your book, which is called Robot Souls, Programming in Humanity. I ask the obvious question, how do you program in humanity?
Well, I mentioned in the first section my idea about junk code and all the things we haven't programmed in. And when you start looking
But just you don't think they're junk. I mean, it's an interesting phrase, but actually, does that mean they are regarded as junk, but you don't think they are?
Absolutely. If you think about how junk code is used in the trade, it tends to mean in strings of code, some zeros and ones or whatever the modern equivalent would be in coding, that is a bit confusing. It's not quite clear why it's there, but people are a bit scared to delete it in case it's actually part of something rather crucial that is driving the whole design. So job code could just be perplexing, bizarre, possibly redundant extra bits. It's also used by programmers to obfuscate so that it's harder for their code to be copied. So quite often they will mask the actual kind of live bits of code by putting a load of junk code around it, so it makes it harder for people to copy. So whichever way you want to use this as a definition, it's quite a useful definition for all those things that we have left out of AI, either because we're not quite sure why they're there, or because whoever our designer was, whatever we think about that, may have made it less easy for us to see exactly how coded we are.
So what specific things would you think of programming in? And it obviously leads to the question about whether ultimately you're going to create robots that are more intelligent or sensitive or whatever than we are. But let's not get that yet. What would you program?
So we talked a bit about consciousness, and that is one of the concerns that people have about AI, that somehow if we reach that stage where AI is definitely conscious, we've kind of lost it and we have to, you know, give up and go off and play golf and game over. I think it's actually much more about free will. Because if AI has something that looks like free will, then you do lose control of it in the same way that we've always had that problem with our children when they have minds of their own, start going off and becoming goths and, you know, being anarchists and all that kind of thing. So what's going to happen if we lose control of this? And that's why you get these big letters about the control problem and alignment and all of these kinds of bits of jargon. But if you think
hold on a second. I'm sorry, forgive me, but I'm so far behind the curve on this. I don't know how you're given the free will in the sense there's an argument about whether free will exists, of course, but we're not going to that one. But presumably free will allows you to make, as it were, the wrong decision.
Yes. Right.
The whole point I've thought about artificial intelligence in its the claims made for it, that it, in its limited area, will always make the best decision. So if you say you're going to program in free will, are you programming in the possibility of robots making the wrong decision, and why would you wish to do that?
Well, I think the boat's already sailed on that, which is why the junk code becomes terribly important, because in robotics and in AI, deep learning gives you the ability to instruct the AI to reprogram itself if it would help it better meet its objectives. Now, there are some guardrails and parameters around that, I'm sure, but again, given how hard we're trying to catch up with exactly how do you give precise instructions that are the ones you really mean, and given how bad we are as that at humans, it's quite difficult to know whether you've absolutely made that as safe as possible by only giving the right instructions to the AI such that it would be able to make, quotes, the right decision, which is this thing about alignment and control. But if you start thinking about our own design, now whether you think that's about evolution, just tinkering away to improve and improve and improve, or whether you think that's God, there are elements of our design that seem to be in there to help protect us since we have free will. Because if you give something like us free will, there is a high chance that that species is going to go extinct really quickly by making terrible decisions and then, you know, no more humans. So in order to make this free will species able to survive, you have to do a number of kind of risk management maneuvers around the design. So I mentioned two of the first sort of stabilizers. One is emotions, and that's a very practical thing, which is if you have, in our species, a 9-month gestation period and you have babies being pretty defenseless and unable to care for themselves for such a long period of time, you need something that would make mothers want to nurture them and want to carry them, want to ask help from other people, want to respect their elders who might also help them, all these kinds of bonds and emotions and loyalties and love that keep us together in tribes. So emotions is rather crucial to give us those kinds of fundamental abilities to want to relate to others of our species. And then for when you can't quite decide what to do, we have access to something we call intuition, which will often serve us up the answer from some subterranean place. And again, we can argue what intuition is. We're never quite sure, but is a way of kind of channeling to us some wisdom, either about people and how we're reading them and whether we should trust them, or about situations around us. So then when we're into this idea about error, because the problem about free will is you can make mistakes, there are a couple of ways we sort of deal with that in our own design, if you like. One is mistakes, and that's partly, as I mentioned earlier, the mechanical business of learning how to walk. You know, you fall down and then you kind of figure out how to balance. And, you know, there's lots of things where we learn by failing and picking ourselves up again, trying again. That's something they're already coding into AI as part of learning technologies. But the other way that we use mistakes as a species is, as I mentioned, this idea about conscience, that over time, our mistakes grieve people. They make people shout at us. They make us not popular, all those kinds of things. We get feedback from the people around us, and that develops in us a sense of conscience. So we try and stay on the straight and narrow in the future. And of course, if conscience is working really, really, really well in a human, you would very rarely need law. And you know, there's lots of questions about what's happened in society that we need to quite so much law these days. But that's the point of it in the design, is to try and de-risk you, future-proof you, stop you making particularly errors that would harm other people, because that will also keep you safe. And then there is this idea of uncertainty, because if you are too precipitous in your decision-making, given that you're a fallible human being with this free will, you might make many more mistakes. So the idea of uncertainty is it makes you pause and stop and check before you sort of rush into anything. The final two, just to finish on that, that would be things that I'd be interested in understanding how they could help AI, are our ability to make meaning, which helps us want to keep on living. So even if you have safeguarded the species onto this very day, what is going to make it want to get out of bed in the morning on a dark day, or recover from some harm or some problem or some death or some grief? And that's about making meaning, and it's about storytelling to communicate lessons we've learned through the centuries. And of course, the religions are particularly good at that. They have kept their stories largely intact for thousands of years in order to be able to communicate down the generations what good looks like, what happens to good people, what happens to bad people, why we're here, all of these kinds of wisdoms and truths, again, to try and keep the species going. So those are all ways that we, in our code, try and stop us going rogue, as it were. So I'm curious about what we could learn from that about how we're designing AI or how we're not designing AI and what we might do about that.
Yes. Well, it hasn't stopped certain people going rogue with disastrous effects, but let me come across, that's a rather obvious remark, I'm afraid, but that's do you think this is A, possible, B, desirable, the sort of line of that Eve is going down? Is it something which is a worthwhile attempt, even if it's extraordinarily difficult to implement, or not?
And so I don't like to make definitive statements about where we should be going as an anthropologist. I'm just very interested in the stories we're telling ourselves about these paths and these routes. And for some people, yes, absolutely, they are certain that we should develop artificial life forms. We should either develop them as our sort of mind children, as a term that's used amongst transhumanists, people who think technology is the way to continue our evolution, that our mind children will follow after us and continue our form of civilization out into the stars for infinity. Others think that we should ourselves become a part of those future humans. We should ourselves become post-human through mind uploading in some form. So yes, for some people, the speculation on whether all of this is possible to make a completely human-like AI of some formats, whether it's embodied or not, or purely digital, is the end goal. For some figures who are driving funding and policy and developments, like Elon Musk, there's others, of course, this is absolutely where we should be heading. We should find a way to make them as human-like as possible. And then, obviously, conversely, there are people who say this just isn't possible. As you mentioned, the efficiencies of AI at this stage of a capitalist system is to make it run effectively for particular tasks. It's not so we can have a decent conversation with it and see it as an equal. It's purely for it to be a tool. So for those people, narrow AI is good enough and we should go no further. We should make it effective and not full of disinformation and misinformation. But there are those sort of two distinct paths. The problem is that sometimes people on the more transhumanist path are not being that honest about why they're developing this technology, why they're funding it. Some of the figures behind OpenAI and generative forms of AI are actually more focused on that exponential future of where we're going with artificial life forms, rather than saying we're trying to make the world better as it is now. Their concerns are not about the direct impact on people's lives now. The numerous numbers of people in Africa who have been employed to make generative ChatGPT work on pittance of wages, they're not the concern. It's the future generations to come. And we should have a very open and honest conversation about people's goals in this space.
Well, we pause there, if we may, at the end of the second section, come back to the third to talk about, if we may, the impact of one of the things we want to talk about is the impact of this on religion, on faith, and on this astonishing idea that we thought we were unique, and we may be considering not making ourselves unique, or even making something else superior to us, which is an extraordinary idea. Thank you. This is you're listening to Unbelievable, the show that tries to get Christians and non-Christians thinking about the topics that matter to all of us. And it'd be hard to argue we're not doing that at the moment. And should robots, can they have souls in the future? Can they really be conscious like us? And what rights do we give them? And where does it leave conventional belief? I'm Roger Bolton. My guests are Eve Poole and Beth Singer. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Unbelievable at premier.org.uk. Welcome back to Unbelievable. I'm Roger Bolton, and my guests are Eve Poole and Bess Singler. And Eve, can I come to you and pick up where we were before? Something which perplexes me is this: if we're talking about imparting into robots aspects of human, what we've thought are human nature, emotions, and so on, one of the things that underpins religion, surely, is a sense that we're all deeply flawed. Behind the idea of original sin and so on, and it's one of the things that we look to religion to protect ourselves against, or in a way, our flaws, which we're very aware of, the irrational decisions we make, the harm we cause, and certainly the 20th century, well, 21st century now, has enough horror in it to make us aware of that. So when you talk about in transmitting or transposing some of these things to robots, how do you eliminate all of those flaws in humanity that have brought us to make terrible things happen? I don't know how you, as it were, take the best bits of us and graft that on to robots.
Well, I think that's why we're in this mess, is because we took what we thought were the best bits and put them into AI because we thought everything else was a flaw. I'm not sure it would be possible to design a flawless anything. Because I don't know if we know enough to be able to do that. But I think we're in a situation where we've written off a lot of our own attributes as problematic without trying to really understand why they're there. Now, it is true that people have done dreadful things. And, you just need to turn the radio on in the morning to see that. It is also true that as a species, we're still going. And I think it means that, on average, the diversity we currently have in our design seems to be resilient. And I'm not sure what I think about whether we should just become robots and all push off. I haven't really got that far, because, as Beth says, I'm trying to look at the sort of short and medium term rather than potential disastrous futures. I'm trying to figure out what we do now. What I would observe is that when you start trying to understand our so-called flaws, you start seeing behind them a spooky wisdom, which is actually about how to keep us safe. And sometimes that does go wrong, of course. What one might hope that if an AI has access to way much more information and wisdom, through the ages, depending on what data it's been trained on, it might make better decisions, particularly if it has the kind of attributes we have that try and help us make better quality decisions, even from a position of not always
knowing. Yeah, but you use a phrase like better, and that's better is a value judgment. I mean, to some extent, religion is irrational. It stands opposed to some aspects of, you could say, Darwinism. It does say, we don't believe in the survival of the fittest. We are not going to be the predators that others are. We are not going to say, this person, because they're born disabled in some way, is of essentially less value than some, even a great scientist. They may be of greater value to society in one way, but as an individual, religion tends to say, everyone's created in the image of God, everybody is valuable in the image of God. It's an irrational thing to do, standing back. You could argue...
Well, so here's an example of where religion is helpful, thinking about rationality. So if you think about programming ethics into AI, and if you think about driverless cars, and you think about the logic of capitalism in terms of the sort of go-to ethic, it's all about utilitarianism. It's all about business cases and optimizing outputs and all that kind of stuff, because then you can prove to the public or your investors or whoever you need to that, the outcomes are good. So during COVID, there was a suspicion that in the UK, the government had been pursuing a herd immunity strategy. And it became apparent that that would involve, throwing all the old people and disabled people and people with pre-existing conditions under a bus in order to save the sort of better specimens of humanity in some sort of ghastly Darwinian intervention to kind of save the NHS a load of money. And of course, the reaction from people was absolute disgust and horror. That's my granny you're talking about, and it's my child you're talking about, and I'm not happy about that. Because the rationality in religion, as you say, is about the dignity of the person, and it's about being able to entertain the idea that utilitarianism may be a very useful way of understanding how to optimize outcomes, but also having a default in our ideology that there is something about the dignity of the person which that would absolutely trespass on, which overrides the business case of herd immunity. And there are loads of examples where we're not really having those conversations about what precisely are those overrides, while we still don't want to clone. Because, you know, one way to sort out AI is just to allow cloning with a few enhancers. It's a damn sight quicker than trying to copy these bodies if you actually just copied them. But of course, we don't do that because we're very worried about eugenics, because we've learnt the hard way that eugenics is a is an absolute disaster.
Yeah, well, so as you say, we learned the hard way, but we not before some terrible things happened, not least in certain hospitals in Germany in the late 1930s and early 40s. Can I come across, Beth, on this? If this were possible to do, we confront a situation where we are helping to create some form of species. I'm not sure about the language I can use here, but entity, which is superior to us. And if it has free will, presumably it might take the view that we are dispensable, and it would be sensible, since it is a more advanced form of life, if we can use that term, that to dispense with us. You know, in other words, we are helping to sow the seeds of our own destruction here. Now, is this science fiction, or are we seriously now facing the prospect of helping to create a superior life force to ourselves, the end of our uniqueness in other ways?
I mean, this is a very strong narrative in those transhumanist spaces that I was talking about before, that the fear of an existential risk, that literally the end of humanity could be brought about because we're replacing ourselves. If you imagine the hierarchical pyramid of intelligence, we've placed ourselves on the top. We have the ability to manipulate our environment. We have the ability to control lower intelligences. And we've popped ourselves at the top. And if we get replaced at the top, that's going to be disaster. That is a very strong narrative. It sort of ignores some of the presumption about who's at the top, how we've encountered other intelligences before, and how we've learned to treat them better than we did initially. I mean, women are a prime example of this. We weren't always treated like we were at the top of the pyramid along with the men. But over time, and not universally, but over time, women get treated a little bit better than we have done in the past. So some of the debate is about whether recognizing this other intelligence might be a way of forming a relationship with it that means that we aren't replaced at the top of this pyramid, if you believe in that pyramid, that actually we might have a more sympathetic relationship with an artificial life form, let's call it that if we want to. That there's parallels drawn with narratives about what would happen if we encountered aliens. Would that be an immediate disaster because they're superior to us in some way? Or would they be more paternalistic or maternalistic and decide to include us in their larger society and civilization? So there's these sorts of debates. And yes, they're very informed by the imagery of science fiction. And it's worth bearing in mind that science fiction exists as a literary and fictional form because of tension. You can't have a plot without some form of conflict. So you have to have some form of dystopia or some arch nemesis. There's a sort of format of that that's being transposed onto our discussions about AI. So we start seeing AI fitting in those spaces, but also as my work is about AI and religion, it's fitting into religious spaces as well. So as I said, AI is increasingly being discussed in a godlike manner. People's language is very religious when they talk about AI, because it reminds them of their cultural context and their religious forms that they're familiar with. So we have to be aware of the stories that we're telling ourselves about this and how that can obscure, as Eva's also said, we want to focus on the near future and what's actually happening now. And actually, if we get too caught up in our fears about a superior intelligence that's going to take over the world and get rid of us, we won't see the very inferior forms of intelligence and misinformation and disinformation that are already shaping our world as it exists now.
Eve, can I bring us, we're going towards the end of our discussions, bring us back perhaps to the impact of all this on the religious and of the future of faith, whether it needs to adapt in some way. Some people, some Christians in particular, listening or watching this may feel that, A, we were unique. We are created in the image of God. Robots won't be, bluntly, that we're given and have been given a special place at the top of creation. What you're now saying is that, at the very least, we'll need to share that in some ways. Do you think, see any of this as a threat to what we might call conventional religion, or is it just another challenge that religion can adapt to if it concentrates on things like love, truth, beauty, and so on?
I think lucky people who are religious. If you think about this, if you were a secular person looking at this, and you have a materialistic narrative, which is just about evolution exponentially improving us, then, of course, if there are technologies available that would improve us, that don't involve us, then that would be logical and a next step. Because in order to believe in humans, you have to believe in God. Because there should be nothing special about us if we're just a species like any other species. You know, what's to say the mice or the dolphins or the mountains or the trees shouldn't be the apex species? You know, it's outrageous, really, to argue that humans are special.
Well, it may be outrageous, but there in the beginning of Genesis, sorry to interrupt you, there at the beginning of Genesis and so on would be us being given dominion over animals and or whatever, and that we are made...
Exactly. So yeah. The only way we're special is because God made us, and that makes us special. But if you don't believe in God, then you can't really argue that humans are special.
Or you can argue conversely and say that lots of things are special. I mean, we've used AI and we've unpacked what that term means. We haven't unpacked religion as much to say that there are various different religious interpretations that actually say all the elements of creation, however you define the act of creation, are very special. And actually that there are uniquenesses around, that we don't need a hierarchical pyramid form with dominionism that leads to environmental harm because we can leave it all behind. We can think about how we exist in an ecosystem or a cosmology of potential other beings. I mean, this is one argument from people who are more panpsychic to say that AI will be part of that creation because it's something emerging in that space. We have to be aware, I'm an anthropologist, I'm thinking about lots of different religions. There's lots of different attitudes to this as well, not just the more hierarchical.
I think that's true. And I think particularly in Christianity, the thing that is of note is that Jesus was a human person. So God incarnated and chose that species to be God. So my point about believing in humans and believing in God is that particularly for Christians, we have a particular reason to think that humans are special and precious because we were made in God's image and God used us when he wanted to incarnate. And so that's one of the reasons I think Christians need to be absolutely in this conversation, because it's a very unusual perspective, I suppose. It's just one of many religious perspectives. But it is a unique argument for human exceptionalism, because otherwise I don't think there is one. And that's really where I ended up in my thinking.
There are also Christian theologians, because Christianity is not a monolithic form either. There are Christian theologians discussing AI who are thinking more about it in terms of a co-creation. They're looking at the transitions of ideas of Imago Dei, that it wasn't always likeness. Now we're talking more about relationality. It's not just functionist. So there has been developments in that theological argument. As I say, I come at it as an anthropologist observing these different trends in the theologies, but there are different interpretations of how we all fit together in a cosmology of beings, even in Christianity.
But Beth, is there a difference, and perhaps there isn't a difference, put me right on this, between where we're talking in conventional, as we're religious or Christian terms, about creation and our responsibility for creation? But now we're beginning to talk about us creating something, not God creating, us creating something that has never existed.
Well, again,
is that unique, or have we been involved in doing that in many other ways?
Again, I can point towards people who talk about continuous creation of God, right? Through evolution, through other formats, through even techne as a form of an aspect of the creation of God. So, I mean, it's not without the bounds of possibility that if you believe in an omnipotent deity, then that's one of the forms in which creation could happen.
And do you think there's
just to throw that these are other narratives that are possible?
And there's another narrative possible, that people start worshipping robots.
Well, AI new religious movements do already exist.
They already exist.
So yeah, I've been studying a few for a while, but it's very fluid between the more kind of implicit religious forms of people seeing AI and describing in godlike terms, and people who are forming more bounded organizations. So some of my work is about the future of religion in the sense of the future of the institution of religion. and developments in spirituality in digital spaces. So yes, you're seeing new formations of communities around the concept of AI as a godlike entity.
And Eve, do you see that as a threat? I mean, you know, we've heard very recently, there's just been a survey in this country, in England, about Church of England priests. I think Linda Wood had conducted it and suggested that they are very pessimistic about the future of, if not Christianity, then the adherence to it and so on. But there's still spiritual hunger. I mean, the thing that strikes me is the obvious point. Actually, in some ways, Linda Woodhead's earlier studies showed this, that people are not abandoning religion. They are making their own journeys. Maybe it's a pick and mix religion. They lose faith in established religion. But the need is there and the journey is there. Could the journey logically end up for large numbers of people in a worship of robots?
I think that if you're trying to understand what, or trying to discover what a religious approach should be to this, then I think that pretty much all the religions are about love. And they're about what are we doing in love at the moment, not in fear about, are we going to be taken over? Is it game over? Have we deserved it? You know, will someone, you know, all of that stuff. It is speculation and it is fear and therefore a lack of trust in an omnipotent God if you believe in one. So there is something about love. And as you say, we have been made in God's image and now we're trying to make something in our own image and doing it rather badly. So my argument is that if we really loved these things that we're trying to create in our image, wouldn't we do a better job of it? And then we have to just leave the future up to how well we've done that. In the same way that you have your children, you try and do the very best you can with them, and ultimately you have to let them go and you have to take that risk. And I think we could speculate about what may or may not happen in the future. But at the moment, that's up to us. And I think we have to stop sleepwalking and imagining someone else is going to get involved and get stuck in and try and figure out what we can do to try and do the best we can in the situation we find ourselves in.
But the two things that immediately, you know, come in my mind is this. One is with children. They are children. They have a long time to grow up. While they're growing up over a long period, we have the opportunity of influencing, of course, for good or for evil. And that when they aren't growing up and go off, they're unlikely to be able to find themselves in a situation where they can destroy us. And I suppose there's a difference here with robots. I mean, could you have baby robots? Could you have this robot must go to university? I mean, I know these are naive terms, but the sense in which a lot of what we have learned.
ChatGPT is a good example, because ChatGPT is like a slightly crummy teenage intern at the moment. So you have interns rocking up to your office. You're trying to be really nice to them because they're probably your boss's son, you know, on his gap year or something. And, you know, you give them a piece of work to do. They come up with something that's frankly a bit flaky, but you don't want to upset them. So you're sort of all very upbeat about it and you stay up all night correcting it. And then hopefully they'll do better next time. And ChatGPT is kind of like that at the moment. You know, and as Beth says, you ask it questions about yourself and it just lies. It sort of says all these things which it can easily find out about you and then hyperbolizes in the most magnificent fashion to sort of cheer you up about how famous you are, in the same way that a kind of rather creepy intern would be doing. And so ChatGPT is in training mode in the same way that a teenager would be. And we need to train it, and we need to train it really well so that actually it isn't garbage in, garbage out. So I think there are some corollaries. I mean, you can stretch this metaphor of parenting to destruction because, you know, they are different from us. They are not human. But if we are attempting to make anything in our own image, my point is that we need to do that much better than we are.
Beth, yeah, let me make you representative of academia entirely, represent all academia just for the moment. What can you do with students who come to you, faced looking to that future? How do you begin the process of preparing them for it?
It's really difficult because I also, like Eve, I have one child, she has two, but I have an 11-year-old boy and, you know, trying to talk to him about what he's interested in. I want to encourage him if he has creative passions, but I'm also seeing the possible death of the creative industries at the moment. It's a very real fact. This could happen. So it's difficult. And my students are a little bit older than that. They're already at university. They're already choosing to study arts and humanities subjects because they come to me to be taught about digital religion. So they already have that passion for the areas in which Eve has described as not the, you know, the purely efficient areas of subjects of STEM and so forth, that they also do some STEM subjects. It is difficult to know what paths to suggest, but all we can do is from a grassroots level really vote with our feet and not take the easy path of saying, well, I need an image for the front cover of my book. I had this recently. I have a book coming out hopefully in the next year. And the suggestions for covers a lot of the time were AI art. And I said, no, I don't want to. I want to have something that's been created by a human being. I'm making this distinct choice. I ended up commissioning a friend of mine who's an artist to make the cover. We can make choices. Some things are taken out of our hands at a very high level, but at a grassroots level, we can protest. The A-level results a couple of years ago with an algorithm determined grades. Students were out on the streets with placards. Amazon workers are standing with placards. We have to support the people in Hollywood who are striking right now because they want to protect themselves from performance capture if they're actors. They want to protect themselves if they're writers and they're going to be replaced by ChatGPT. We have to stand up and take a stance.
And do you think, Eve, that there's a specific role here for the churches and church leadership? Because, I mean, I have the good fortune to be in St. Albans Diocese in England. There's a particularly good priest there who given talks and so on. But I don't know why it's true or not, but it appears to me the diocese doesn't really appreciate what he's doing or giving great prominence. Do you think this needs to be a wake-up call for organized religion, and in the case of the Church of England, to actually not start the process, I suppose, but at least push the process of getting people to prepare? Because presumably you have to do two things, which are very difficult, but politicians, I suppose, have always had to do. One is it's an alarm, a wake-up call, and the second thing, give hope. Because if you just give alarm, it's all hopeless. People sort of, well, why bother? So somehow you've got to alert people, then you've got to give them hope. Is that what you're trying to do in your book? And do you think there's a responsibility on religious leadership now to do that?
Absolutely. And I think it is a call to arms because in the Church of England, if you take over a new parish, the bishop comes to install you and he hands you a bit of paper and says, take this cure of souls, which is yours and mine. And there is this very old notion of cure of souls and that's what someone is doing in a parish. Is every single soul in that parish is their responsibility and they need to take care of them. So all religions, but Christianity in this instance, have a tradition of being specialists in the cure of souls. So all of these things I talked about emotions and storytelling, all of these things which could go so badly wrong, one of the functions of religion is to try and, through liturgy and belief and worship and all of those things, keep us on track. And actually, we're expert at that. All these vicars who up and down the country go to that church every Sunday to remind people of the stories about what happens if you're bad. You know, that is exactly what we need because we need to be curing our souls and we need to be thinking about what our souls are, what the attributes are of them that need protecting and curing. And in my argument, being generous about that understanding in terms of helping inform better design of AI. So I think it is a moment where the church could really add huge value.
You haven't quite answered my question because you made a powerful case for what the church should be doing. You haven't told me whether you think actually there's that awareness at the leadership that it needs to be doing that and it's going to implement it. You know, I see a lot of reorganization. I see a lot of worries about declining attendances. I see a lot of concerns about churches crumbling and what are we going to do about buildings. I don't hear that much about this, and I mean, they need to get a move on. The issues are so complex.
Well, the bishops have been involved for a while in the national conversations about regulation. They're obviously involved through the House of Lords of various committees in some of these discussions about ethical AI. There have been quite a lot of attempts within the Church of England to be part of those conversations and ecumenically. And I know, for instance, the Church Chimes is doing a massive special edition on this. There's going to be webinars. There was loads of sessions at Greenbelt this weekend, which is a largely Christian festival. There's a huge groundswell of engagement around this issue and more people finding each other to talk about what they think AI means. What does it mean practically in a pastoral sense? You know, if an AI has written your wedding service, does that mean it's sacramental or not? You know, there's all these very deep pastoral questions, let alone would it be a sacrament if a robot took it. So this is something where the church is already engaging, but I think there is still, as Beth says, an obsession with sci-fi and therefore an awful lot of extreme utopian, you know, dystopic thinking that is paralyzing people. And I suppose my request is that the experts stand up. You know, all these people who make a living out of cure of souls are really good at this stuff, and it's the skill set we need now.
And Beth, do you see that from your anthropological, shall we say, anthropologist perspective, that happening? And do you think there is a spiritual hole that needs to be filled in this debate? You know, I talked about, if you like, the sense of possibilities from engineering, from other point of view, and the pessimism that it can have. But still, there is a spiritual role here that needs to be emphasised.
So I have had conversations with people from many higher levels of many different religions, and I've had particular conversations with people in the Church of England about questions about sort of divestment from tech companies that could be developing AI, whether that's a concern. There's a lot of obviously existing conversation about divestment from BP or Shell because we're worried about climate change, but should we also think about the entanglements of the institution of the church with technology companies and where their investments are lying? So there's that kind of conversation. But, you know, it's not too many years ago that Church of England released an Alexa skill, so you can use your home Alexa to find out more information about the Church of England. And all that, again, is based on machine learning systems that are drawing data from people who don't always know that their data is being used. So there is this entanglement when religions adopt technology. They have to choose which forms of technology, but they have to also be aware of what kind of changes of shape are going to happen to their institution as that technology becomes very ubiquitous. COVID-19 was a massive example of this, the quick move online of church spaces. But what did that do to worship? What did that do to the church institution? There's a two-way street there. And your second point, the thirst for religiosity, I think.
Yeah, whether or not that is just a constant. In other words, it's something which is built into us so that we still will have a spiritual hunger that will need to be fulfilled somehow.
There's a lot of debates in the anthropology of religion where that comes from. I tend to avoid what's known as a deprivation theory, an idea that we're always lacking something and we try and fill that gap, like God of the gaps of our interiority, that we always need religion. And that can be quite a pejorative interpretation of why people are religious, because they've got this need or this pathology that needs to be sorted. So I avoid that.
Maybe because it's true. I mean, we may have the need because there's truth there.
My interpretation tends to be, yes, there is a constant tendency towards meaning making and storytelling, and we fulfill that in religious and spiritual ways. And when you're surrounded by the aesthetics of technology, of course, that is going to get enmeshed in your meaning making. The meaning making that was happening 2,000 years ago in the Middle East is very different to the meaning making happening now in our, you know, quotation marks, Western or first world civilizations. So yes, of course, you're going to have new religious movements that focus on technology. They're not even that new. We're talking about 30 or 40 years of them with the rise of the internet. And prior to that, spiritualism was, you know, foundationally affected by the telegraph system. All these things are well studied in the sociology and anthropology and history of religion. So yes, we're going to have them. It doesn't mean people are deprived in particular ways, but established religions have to be aware of the two-way street that's going to happen as people get more interested in technology and it affects their religious observance.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to bring our discussion to a close. I'm very, very grateful personally, and I'm sure the listeners would be, for the light you've shone on an extraordinary future that we're all facing. Beth Singler, Eve Poole, thank you very much indeed. I hope you all enjoyed the discussion, and as always, let us know what you think. But for at least until the next time, goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed that discussion. Do let us know what you think by emailing us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or you could leave comments on our Facebook page, Premier Unbelievable, or Twitter, which is @unbelievablefe. If you register on our website, then you will get access to all the content on the website, as well as bonus materials such as videos and ebooks, as well as the opportunity to win our monthly book draw. So sign up for our newsletter through premierunbelievable.com for your chance to win. That's all for this week. We will see you next time for more Unbelievable.